It is Friday, November, 8th? Big show today. A lot to talk about. Big news this morning, Chase Young. We'll get to that in a little bit here after the intro, but also have some other great stuff going on. Alabama, LSU analysis, and then really want to talk. We're gonna bring on 247 Sports and Florida State insider Josh Newberg. Going to join us. Also, Big Three roll-up guest, as he put it, regular guest. So excited to get him on, talk about Florida State, what's going on there, and really excited to talk about this LSU Alabama game also, because we went back and rewatched three games each and broke down what I think of each position group and matchup. And the biggest problem I had was I wanted to pick the best games thus far, and I didn't know what game to pick for Alabama. I mean, A&M, South Carolina, Tennessee or Duke? Is that the top three, top four? It was wild. So excited to get to that, but let's get to the show.
That's why I don't read the newspaper, because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in the media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my
All right, welcome to Menace to Society, or the college football, I guess, insider show, under the hood, just trying to give you some perspective from a former college coach. I want to start off talking about this Chase Young fiasco that had just came out. And from the people that I've talked to, this is something that happened last year involving taking advance from an agent, and it involved a family member. And here's my question, and really what I want to know, as the details unfold. Obviously, he's not going to play this weekend versus Maryland, and his season and college career is certainly in doubt. And so the question here is, why did this come out right now? How many times have you heard of a situation like this, a la Reggie Bush, Cam Newton, all the stuff that happened at LSU? And it comes out eventually. People find out about it eventually. But it's always after the fact. The player gets to live out their college career, win awards, do all these things, and then 5 years down the road, you find out, oh, Boosters bought Reggie Bush's parents a house. Or, oh, Cam Newton's dad took like 500 grand for him to go to Auburn. Why is it just coming out now in the middle of the season? Why is this not 5 years down the road? And my issue is this. I haven't found out the details of who reported it, who found out about it, but I know Ohio State really well. And here's what either happened or is happening. They have a guy there named Doug Archie. He's in charge of compliance. He's an absolute clown. He is the worst of the worst. You want to know why Ohio State gets slammed on stupid things over when it seems like people in the South are getting away with murder? Because Doug Archie. I told the story before about the time that I got accused of paying a recruit, which has never happened. But the way he treats people at Ohio State is like he is the FBI trying to frame someone for murder. So I promise you this, something happened. Chase Young might not have even known about it. But the reason why all this is happening the way it's happening is because of the compliance department at Ohio State. And I get it. If this is the NCAA doing it, then Ohio State is going to try to appeal it. But make no mistake about it, Ohio State is being the world police on this one at the compliance department. It's just wild, isn't it, how an LSU booster takes money from a church or something. He took 500 grand from I think it was a church and paid players with it. And it's like that was on the news for 10 minutes and then no one heard about it again. Oh, but this Chase Young story, it's going to be all they talk about outside of Alabama LSU. He killed his chance for the Heisman. It's just ridiculous. But I don't want to talk too much about that. We'll definitely follow up on Sunday after we get more information. But from all accounts, Chase Young's career at Ohio State is probably over. And if I was going to put money on who dropped the ball on this outside of some wrongdoing by someone in associated with Chase or Chase himself, then it's going to be Doug Archie in the compliance department because they have a longstanding history of dropping the ball. So it's sad to see. You hate to see it. And really, really disappointed for Chase. But here's another thing that I saw in the media that's absolutely sickening. There was this guy, Karen J. Phillips. I don't know if I'm sure no one's heard of him. He's a a big time sports reporter and has 4,000 followers on Twitter. So, but he made news because people started retweeting this thing about Megan Mullen kisses players and it's sexual assault and all this other nonsense. And it's just being in the coaching industry, you sit there and wonder, like, one, why are you retweeting that story? First of all, if you watch the video, she hugs them. She maybe gives them a kiss on the cheek, but this is like family. That's what the coaches that do it the right way. It's like family. And somehow we're going to sit here and act like she did something improper. And people want to spin the, well, if it's a man and a woman, that's, I hate to break it to you, that's different. It just is. And I don't care if you agree or don't agree. It's different if there was an 18-year-old girl getting off a bus and the coach's husband is giving them kisses and hugging them up like that. It's just different. I don't know what to tell you about it. If you don't agree, you need to wake up. But never mind that. She's not kissing them on the mouth. She's not doing anything improper. She's showing them that her and her family care about them and their success and their life. And we want to like demonize that? This guy, Karen J. Phillips, should be run out of the industry. That's the reality of the industry. He should be done. Outrageous. But also, I saw another thing on Twitter, what would be the 16-team playoff. And man, I'm going to tell you what, do we need to revamp scheduling rules and regulations, shorten the regular season, and get this thing expanded? If you haven't seen it, go on Twitter and search for the 16-team playoff, if it existed. It is really, should be really good. Also, I don't if people that don't follow me on Instagram, it's at Coach Zach Smith, but a memory popped up on my Instagram. We took a selfie in-game against Nebraska, and I don't want to go back into that whole thing, but the receiver coach of Nebraska did a bunch of, I guess, got offended by some things that I tweeted, even though they weren't about him. And then he created this rivalry somehow between himself and me. And so when we beat him, God knows, 100-0, we took a selfie in game, and it just reminded me of how about branding in college football. And what I think I did a great job of was creating this zone six, and it was me and my players did it. And it really transcended what was going on in recruiting, and the impact it had in recruiting was phenomenal. Because when I first got to Ohio State wasn't sexy for skill players, for you know, great athletes. It used to be early 2000s moving backwards, but if you look at the receiver room that I had, there was a couple of guys, like an Ohio guy, an Ohio State legacy. Philly Brown was really the one that had no Ohio State tie that was a really good player that was in the room. But just recruiting Stephon Diggs and then James Quick the next year, just wasn't sexy to go to Ohio State and to play for the Buckeyes. And creating that Zone 6 brand is really what helped me push it over the edge. And so now you're seeing a lot of things happen in recruiting because Ohio State is sexy. Let's not forget, in 2012, nothing about Ohio State was sexy to a receiver or to a skill player. And so that had to be created. And I just, that memory reminded me, we did it in 2014 too, in the national championship game, took a selfie during the game, mind you, me, Tom Herman, a bunch of players. We took a selfie at fourth quarter as we're winning the national championship, just because it was savage. And it was a way to appeal to the younger audience. And so just wanted to bring that up because I thought it was funny, a funny story. And check out my Instagram, the picture's on there from Nebraska. I think it's 2016. But also, I want to talk about the LSU-Alabama preview. It's going to be an awesome game. So, like I said, I went back and watched about six games, roughly three on each team, and really broke down this game. And I guess the biggest news is that LSU's linebacker, Michael Divinity, left the team citing personal reasons. And I hate to hear that, personal reasons. But he did. He was LSU's sack leader. It's going to be a major loss. And usually, I'm not saying it is in this case because I certainly don't know him or what happened with him, but usually when someone leaves a team citing personal reasons, I'd say 95% of the time they were a major violator of a drug policy at the university, meaning multiple failed drug tests. Like I said, I don't know that happened with Michael Divinity, but 97% of the time a player leaves the team citing personal reasons, it's because they failed too many drug tests and they had to leave the team. But I'll tell you the question I'm most excited about is, will Tua Tagovailoa play? It's the strategy, right? Is it strategy or competitive nature? What is Nick Saban's plan? What is he going to do? But you look at Nick Saban, he certainly knows what he's doing in games like this. I mean, he's 76% all time against top 10 opponents. The last 5 years, he's 14-3 against top 10 teams. But what was craziest stat about all this was against top four opponents in the last 5 years, he's 10-2. He has an 83% win percentage against top four opponents. That's unheard of. He's won the also won the last five meetings with LSU when they were a top 10 team. So it's going to be a good game, but let's put it this way. Nick Saban knows what he's doing. But here's what we are about to do. We're about to watch two of the three most electric wide receiver cores in the country roll into Bryant-Denny Stadium Saturday, and they both will have their arsenal ready. Five of the top 10 wide receivers in the SEC grade-wise are going to be on the field. Think about that. Five of the top 10. Ja'Marr Chase at LSU, Justin Jefferson at LSU, Devontae Smith at Alabama, Jerry Jeudy at Alabama. Throwing Jalen Waddle, who was a superstar last year, has had kind of a slower sophomore slump. Terrence Marshall, the red zone threat at LSU. You're going to have six of the best receivers in the country all in Bryant-Denny Stadium on Saturday. It's going to be insanity. You throw into the mix two of the country's best quarterbacks in Tua Tagovailoa and Jose Barroso, and the fireworks will be going off in Tuscaloosa on Saturday. It's going to be epic. It's going to be the game of the year. I really, when I looked at the game, looking at Alabama on offense and LSU on defense, the question is, will Tua be able to light up the LSU secondary? Because they're seventh in America in explosive passes. They have 107 explosive passes this year. They average over 13 per game. And those of you that didn't see the Ohio State breakdown or didn't listen to it, that's one of my most critical things for Ohio State right now is explosions in the pass game. And right now, Alabama is just exploding all over the field in the pass game. And then the question is, can LSU's DBs contain or even cover Alabama's receivers? LSU is one of the most talented secondaries in the country. And when I watch them on film, they show they're susceptible to a talented wide receiver. They have not played many. The best being, I'd say, Van Jefferson at Florida, probably. I mean, Texas was able to expose him for 400 yards passing and four touchdowns. Florida did the same roughly 3 weeks ago, four touchdowns, 311 yards passing. The best wide receiver they have faced to date, like I said, Van Jefferson, Florida, has to be. He had a huge impact. 8 catches, 73 yards, 2 touchdowns. He had a big game, which makes you ask two questions. Why doesn't Florida feature him more? And two, what is this Alabama receiver core going to be able to do? How will Derek Stingley Jr. and Grant Delpit and the rest of the secondary manage a defense that relies heavily on man coverage? When you watch it, almost every snap is some form of man coverage. When they are facing by far the greatest skill at wide receiver to date, Devontae Smith, Jerry Jeudy, Henry Ruggs, the top two are better than anyone LSU has faced. Last year, the crew was able to go for almost 300 yards and two scores when they won 29-0, and Jerry Jeudy went off for 100 yards. So the question is, what is going to happen on the perimeter? I will say the loss of Michael Divinity will certainly hurt, as he was an explosive player and a pass rush difference maker on this defense. Leading tackler Jacob Phillips is going to have to increase his already stellar play, and he's going to have to make up for it ultimately. I did hear one interview talking to, I believe it was Dave Aranda and some LSU defensive players, talking about Alabama loves slant routes. So just get ready for Steve Sarkisian to put in compliments off of slants, because Alabama knows that they run a lot of slant routes, but to hear LSU talk about having a specific plan to stop slant routes, that's red flags. Automatically, you're saying, all right, they're going to be trying to jump the hell out of our slants. We're going to put in a slant and go. We're going to put in these compliments off of slants. So just get ready for that. That'll happen. But here's the thing when I watch Alabama that they do really well, and it's called a sight adjust to a slant. I mean, people say, oh, they run slants to stop the slants. Well, there's a reason they do it. Because what I've seen on film is they'll sight adjust a slant. And what I mean by sight adjust a slant is when the defense blitzes, they will do what's called replace the blitzer. So if, let's say, the linebacker inside of the number three receiver blitzes, that receiver then knows that the protection scheme can't pick up that certain linebacker, and so he will sight adjust his route, run a hot route, and turn his route into a slant and replace that blitzer to get in the void. And just get ready for Urban Meyer to go on Fox Big Noon Kickoff and talk about sight adjustments and replacing blitzers, because that'll come down the road at some point. He's huge on it. But that's what happens. someone blitzes and you can't account for it in protection, either the quarterback has to do a very subtle signal to tell the receiver, hey, if this guy comes, I need a slant, or it's already built into their scheme. We did both at Ohio State. But I will tell you this, and the run game at Alabama is certainly second fiddle to their throw game. But the highly touted Najee Harris leads the charge, but he only gets around 13 touches a game. He was over 20 against Tennessee and A&M, so you can expect him to play a much bigger role in a game of this atmosphere where Saban, a defensive coach, by the way, will want to control the game more so than slinging it around 50 times. So I would look for Najee Harris to have an increased role. He's a top 10 graded back, but just minimal production because of minimal touches. I mean, 59th in rushing yards, 66th in average. But make no mistake, he is capable of explosive plays. I'm excited to watch him. The real story here, though, is LSU's offense. Enter Jose Barrose, Joe Burrow, Heisman frontrunner, potential number one pick to the Cincinnati Bengals. Hopefully not for his sake. Number three in the country and with 84% adjusted completion percentage. Number three in the country on deep balls. He's 22 of 35 on deep balls. And I would tell you this, the greatest thing I took away after going back and rewatching this Alabama team, or this LSU offense, is Joe Brady has custom tailored this offense for Joe Burrow. I went back and watched their plan and execution against Auburn and Florida. It's beautiful. I mean, they had stacks, bunches, picks, man beaters galore all over the field. Then the RPOs to take advantage of teams trying to stop their evolving and improving run game. And I'm going to tell you what, this Clyde Edwards-Helaire, wow, did he burst on the scene in the last two games versus Florida and Auburn. Be prepared for a heavy dose of him in Tuscaloosa. He had 39 carries for 270 yards and three touchdowns in those two games. Almost 7 yards a carry against two of who were top 25 rush defenses until they faced LSU. The real difference that Joe Burrow brings to this offense is what he does when something isn't there. You watch him play, and even when things aren't open, they are covered. The pass protection has been phenomenal. But his ability to keep a play alive, move outside of the pocket, keep his eyes downfield, and make plays playing man coverage defense, it's almost impossible to stop. How long can you cover the three-headed monsters in LSU's receiver room? How long could you actually cover them? I mean, if he escapes the pocket clean, no one in America can cover those guys for 4 seconds. It's not possible. It becomes like backyard football. This is what is making Joe Burrow in this pass game so lethal, is when things don't work and when things don't go well, he escapes the pocket, keeps the play alive, doesn't scramble recklessly, and lets them work, finds a guy 30 yards downfield. It's phenomenal. So the real question here is, what will Nick Saban and Alabama's plan be? Florida went in and thought they could match up in man coverage and got beat pretty much the entire game by this LSU receiver corps. Even when they had excellent coverage, Joe Burrow would escape the pocket, allow his receivers more time, and no secondary in the country can win in a game of backyard football with those freaks on the edge and Jose Barrose wheeling and dealing the ball. The real difference in this game, I think, is going to be critical down in distances. Third down performance. And you look no further than the team that wins third down will win this game, barring some turnover fiasco. Both critical situations are mismatched. They are in favor of both offenses. Alabama is the 40th team in the country getting off the field on third down, and they face the 79th best third down offenses. So what does that mean? I just look at the third down offenses they faced and average them out. Almost the 80th offense in the country on average on third down, and they are only 40th in the country getting off the field. LSU? How about they're the 6th best third down offense in the country? Major contention point in this game. Facing similar competition, on average, 68th best third down offense in the country, Alabama is the number 2 third down offense in America. LSU is the 21st best third down defense. So what does that all mean? That means someone is going to need to step up on defense and win its money down, third down. And whoever doesn't is going to experience drive staying alive and points being scored. Look no further. Whoever wins the third down battle in this epic game of the year is going to win the football game. And in my opinion, Nick Saban doesn't lose at home to anyone, especially in a big time matchup. I think Alabama wins this football game. But We're going to find out Saturday night. That's a good part. But I do want to get away from this for a minute because we have a special guest coming on right now. So let's get to Josh Newberg from Knowles 247 to talk a little bit about the Florida State fiasco, I guess, that's going on. All right, welcome back, Menace to Society. We have on the phone our, I guess, the Florida State liaison. Those of you that remember, I went down to the Miami-Florida Week Zero game, courtesy of the Big Three Roll-Up. Josh Newberg was a huge part of that. He is Josh, would you call it the brains behind the operation there in the Big Three Roll-Up?
I mean, I like to call myself just a weekly guest. They say some outlandish shit, I can just kind of say, no, I'm just a weekly guest. I'm not actually a host.
Right. They just had you on the craziness. But
I'm the ringleader of the circus.
There you go. I like that. Well, I would encourage anyone to, and I'll give Josh a chance to kind of tell you about the podcast that they have down there because it's awesome. I've listened to it every week since we really kind of connected through social media and since I went down to the tailgate, and they are the inspiration for the Penn State tailgate coming up on the 23rd. Still trying to recruit the whole staff to come up and hang out, but we'll see about that here in the next couple weeks. But really wanted to have Josh on because I know I talked about the Florida State situation, debacle, whatever you want to call it, and no one knows more about the program and what's going on than Josh. So Josh, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, man, it's good to be here. How's it feel now? I got to welcome you. You're a member of the media now.
That is the one title I refuse to own. It's
I figured those were fighting words. Why I opened with it.
Yeah, that's a fact.
I'm going to call you member of the media right off the jump here. No, it's great to be here, man. I've been watching closely to what you've been doing. You know, you made an appearance on our podcast. What was it, over the summer? So how many podcasts in were you to Menace to Society when you came on the Big Three Roll-Up?
You know what? I was probably like 10 or 15 in, 10 episodes. Mm.
So from that point to now, like what's the most interesting thing you've learned or done with podcasting?
You know what? It's such a different realm. I mean, just from from true radio, audio media to TV shows, it's definitely the new era of audio media, and it's been really cool to explore it. And I've met with so many like executives, radio executives, and all these people in Columbus that are basically like, yeah, we know it's like the one guy told me, he said, we are like Blockbuster and podcasts are Netflix. Like, we know we're going out of business soon and we're trying to figure out what the hell podcasts are.
Yeah. I think podcast is just a bad name for a platform. It's just platform, because it can be whatever you want. There's no structure to what we talk about. There's no time restraints. There's no commercial breaks when things are getting good. It doesn't even just have to be audio. You know, you can do video with it. You can do all kinds of things. So I love it. I think, you know, keep pushing it, and you guys are doing great. Can't wait to see what comes of your pod.
No doubt. I appreciate it, man. I appreciate it. Well, let's dive into this Seminole Nation issues that are going on. I want to know, talk to me about the ramifications that you are seeing from this entire situation with Willie Taggart and the fallout and recruiting, the fan base, kind of the state of Seminole Nation right now. How do you see it from inside?
Oof, very unstable, but it was really unstable even before this all happened. I mean, you go back to Willie Taggart's tenure, and it's been a short one. He finished 9 wins, 12 losses. He made several coaching changes during his tenure here. He's made some questionable moves. He's recruited well at times. He hasn't recruited well at times. Right now, I would say definitely in a state of limbo. You know how this goes. Anytime a coaching change occurs, the recruiting pendulum will swing way in the negative direction. Florida State has had 3 or 4 decommitments now. Before the Miami game, they had 20 commitments. At this point, I believe they have 17. They're as high as 21 during the season. So they, you know, the majority of the class is stuck together. That's kind of expected with recruiting in this day and age. Like, Florida State doesn't have a full commitment list of kids that are being recruited by Georgia and Alabama and Auburn. You know, they got some kids that had a lot of interest, but at this point, all these commitment classes are so full right now that even if these kids wanted to go elsewhere, it's not like they could necessarily upgrade. And it's not to say they're not talented enough, but it just, you know, spots are taken right now in recruiting. Most of the classes are nearly complete. So that being said, I, you know, we're at 17 commitments. I don't think Florida State's going to drop down to 15, 14. So they'll probably weather the storm. They'll make a new hire. And then the pendulum starts to swing in the other direction. There's excitement. There's hope. The new coach comes in. He goes in a couple homes and convinces some kids to commit. And, you know, they only need to add 10 to 12 pieces probably when all this washes out. So I think recruiting will survive. They got Jeff Sims, a quarterback out of Jacksonville, that has remained committed, at least for now. They did lose a few key pieces, mainly being Jalen Knighton. He's a running back out of Deerfield Beach, four-star player. Had offers from Ohio State, Miami, Clemson, and a couple others, and committed to FSU over the summer. Now, he decommitted on Monday morning. I tend to believe he would have decommitted had Willie Taggart stayed, because that's just where the rumors were heading. But he's probably the biggest piece FSU has lost so far. They got three more weeks of the regular season, and then they'll get out on the road with hopefully a new coach.
Well, that's the crazy thing now is whatever it's been 2 years now with the new signing date. And this is really like trying to find a home. What back in the day used to be like beginning of January. It's like, oh, man, it's getting close to curtain call. You better find something fast. So it's
like a game of musical chairs.
It really is. And it's also sped up this whole coaching search process. When to fire a guy. I mean, you look at Willie Taggart, 2 years, not even 2 years, a year and a half. And he's canned, and it's like, well, you can't wait till after the season to fire a guy anymore. You got to make the call and get a coach in to try to salvage a class.
Hey, I got a question for you. On Saturday night after the Miami game, I don't know if you saw the kind of the viral video of Kirk Herbstreit on the bus where he just eviscerated Florida State and Willie Taggart, the culture, everything. Mm. Did you see that?
I didn't.
Okay, so he got on, and it was a very candid conversation, and it just kind of cut to the core of, like, the character of this team. And it was a little bit beyond a normal critique of Florida State. Now, ESPN loves to shit on Florida State, but this went a little bit extra.
Yeah.
And while I'm not going to really argue with what he said, it was kind of maybe the way he said it, but I had a couple coaches actually call me the next day and say that they think that, you know, honestly was maybe the straw that broke the camel's back, because a person like that, that's so high profile, they're like, you know, with the boosters and everything, like, how do you really come back to that after the Miami loss? Do you think that something like that could weigh in ultimately on a coach's tenure like that? Because it is kind of weird that they would fire him with three games to go.
Yeah, you know what? I think it's like anything else, and though it's very different, I could relate it to my own personal situation where the athletic director might not have, the administration at Florida State might not have put a lot of weight into the media or Kirk Herbstreit or anyone like that. But it's not even, that's not even what's most important. It's when all of a sudden the people with all the money start feeling embarrassed that then they put the pressure on the administration. And then all of a sudden it's like, you find yourself in a situation where you're like, the administration probably didn't want to do this right now, but it's
embarrassing. That's the word.
Yeah. And it forced their hand. And here are millionaires donating all this money and they're embarrassed because Kirk Herbstreit does that. And now they're putting pressure where it counts with dollars, you know? So that.
Yeah. And obviously being embarrassed by Miami was probably the catalyst, 27-10 at home.
Absolutely.
But having, you know, that being said, you know, I just had a couple coaches that reach out to me and said, man, that was it. That was the straw that broke the back. And they, you know, so it's kind of crazy. It's been a while. It feels like it's been 2 weeks since that game ended, but it's only been like 3 or 4 days.
Right. Well, I can imagine in your world, it's been about 2 to 3 weeks worth of work since, since it happened. Right. So here's my next question for you, because I know that, it's not well known nationally, there was a lot of issues with Jimbo Fisher and Florida State, just the culture of Florida State's administration, boosters, etc. And there, you know, they obviously split on bad terms, taking what I would call a major step down to go to Texas A&M. A&M fans probably won't be happy about that, but that's what it was to me. What is the issue at Florida State? Is it just the Bobby Bowden after effect of just having one coach for 40 years that just did things a certain way and then people struggle to change? Or what's wrong at Florida State?
No, I don't think so. I think Jimbo was, you got to look at Jimbo's tenure in like two halves, right? And there was the half where a lot of people, they call it when he was engaged, and that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And then there was the other half where he kind of let things slide. So when he was engaged and when he was recruiting and when that thing was clicking and running on all cylinders, meaning him and I was there to see how he moved in unison with guys like Eddie Grant and James Coley and Damian Craig. And like, they were all, he really had these guys going in the right direction. It sounds a lot like what you talk about with Urban Meyer. I'm sure they're different leaders, but it sounded very similar.
Right.
And they were all very focused on the same goal. Then there's the second half, and that's after the national championship. And he started letting things go. I noticed in, especially in recruiting, in with their evaluation, I started noticing them settling with the low-hanging fruit. Like, instead of landing an Eddie Jackson and a Jerry Jeudy, I'm going to name names, but they would settle for these other guys. While they were highly rated, you know, and I know they're not the same player as the elites that you were recruiting. So
yeah, right.
I think that started to happen. And in the background, him holding not only his staff, but his players accountable started to happen. Now, the debt started piling up, right? Bad grades, bad attitude, bad overall culture, as they say. Well, that debt had to be paid at some point.
Yep.
Willie Taggart got saddled with it, with the debt.
Yeah.
There's no question it came from Jimbo Fisher. Now, what he did with it moving forward, there was his own issues. And there was a lot of things that needed to be cleaned up. He did a good job. The first summer that he got there, they had to literally, I don't know if you ever did this, but they had to have their coaches in the hallways at the school to make sure the kids were going to class, because kids just were not going to class when they arrived there. They had to, during that summer, they were standing outside of classrooms, grown-ass coaches, to make sure kids were going to school.
Oh, I've been there. I have been there.
So there is a lot wrong. And then if you want to get into recruiting, Willie Taggart, and I harped on this, and I was a bad guy in FSU Twitter, and everybody thought that I just was being negative for the sake of being negative, but I harped on this hard. Willie Taggart did not sign a high school quarterback during his entire time at Florida State.
Oh, wow.
He didn't sign one when he first got there. He didn't sign one last year. You see quarterback play at FSU. You see quarterback play around the country. At the end of the day, the only reason he really turned USF around is because he had Quentin Flowers, a transcendent quarterback that, you know, and if anybody would understand the need to have a great quarterback, you'd think it would be Willie Taggart. So I just could not understand for the life of me how they didn't, how they weren't signing more and more arms, you know, like I thought that was a big problem. They didn't address anything on the offensive line. They had no answer when Brian Burns left a pass rusher. They still have no pass rush. They're going to fall off a talent cliff. Jimbo Fisher's guys are about to leave. Willie Taggart, you know, say what you want. He's recruited okay. Number 11 class backed up with the number 14 class. And this was trending to be like a 18 to 20 class before he left. They were going in the wrong direction recruiting. It's the lifeblood of the program. I don't need to describe to you how vital recruiting is. Those that know just could see where this class was sliding. I mean, when he first arrived, he was handed a 64th ranked class from Jimbo Fisher. He brought it to number 11. Outside the top 10, not where you typically see FSU finish, but we all said, well, hey, this is Willie Taggart's first year. He'll never finish further than 11. I mean, we're talking top five, top three classes every year he's here. Why not?
Right.
And it was just sliding backward.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely that's a horrible trend, especially it's one thing if it's a year or two and your team is already loaded, but if you're already expecting departures on all these fronts and you still aren't having that success on the trail, that's going to be a bad deal in a year or two.
Yeah, and Jimbo Fisher recruited number one players at their position, and that's who's leaving. Marvin Wilson, number one defensive tackle in America out of Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Cam Akers, number one running back in America out of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Kalen Mayborn, he was a number one all-purpose back out of Virginia.
Oh, yeah, I recruited him.
Tamarian Terry, he makes plays. I mean, every guy I just named could potentially go to the NFL next year. They're beyond year three. We know Cam Akers will. We know Marvin Wilson will. Probably Tamarian Terry. If you watch FSU, you show me, where's the production going to come? You know, there's huge question marks moving forward. And I think the admin saw this. And I think they wanted to cut bait while they could.
And you know what? What you said, the most alarming thing you've said so far is to not sign a quarterback in two classes. I mean, that's not only with the introduction of the transfer portal world that we live in, but that's just such a important critical position. Like, how you don't take one every year is mind blowing.
Or two every year.
or two every year, right? I mean, it's like I've heard a lot of NFL, former NFL players and even people that are in NFL personnel say you should draft a quarterback every year. And that's the NFL, let alone college, where you're talking about it's a kid.
Yeah, and I watched Jimbo Fisher for 6 years. I covered FSU since 2010. So I watched Jimbo Fisher load up on arms, and people would say, yeah, but Jimbo Fisher missed on all these guys. Yeah, no shit. He knew he was going to miss on guys. He just knows that there's attrition at the quarterback position, and that's why he made sure he was signing two quarterbacks a year. At one point, he had three quarterbacks committed. I asked him, like, do you really, you're going to sign three quarterbacks? And he just said, I'll sign them all. Just let him, you know, if one of them doesn't want to compete, let him go. I'll learn a lot about his, you know, I'll learn a lot about him if he decides to decommit.
Right.
And he did. And they ended up signing two that year. But my point is, like, Jimbo understood that not all these guys pan out. That's why you got to sign more than one.
Yeah, that's a fact. That is definitely a fact. And you know what? You sign two, and you're going to end up with the better of the two, because the other kid's going to leave after he sees the writing on the wall anyways, and then you're going to have a spot for another quarterback in a year or two. It just always works out anyways, you know?
Right.
So here's my next question. So first of all, I'm viewing this from obviously an outsider's perspective, and having been in coaching for whatever 15 years, I just view Florida State as they just won a national championship 6 years ago, but it's such a sleeping giant, especially with the state that the ACC is in right now, being just that one trick pony in Clemson, and they really are looking for a Florida State or Miami to just, I mean, come back strong. And so if they make a home run hire here, they get that superstar coach that they obviously want to get. How good of a job is Florida State?
Florida State's a great job. I mean, just look at what Jimbo Fisher literally took FSU from kind of the same position it is now to in 3 years or 4 years, a national championship. Right. So he just did exactly what you're saying. Florida State was kind of on the trash pile waiting to be taken out. You know, not many people knew where the program was headed. They you got to remember also, like, you're losing Bobby Bowden and you're promoting this guy that's never been a head coach. And he's been, you know, calling plays, and the offense hasn't looked all that great. You're not winning too many games. And now this is going to be the guy that you're backing up a legend with. And in 4 years, he rebuilt the entire program and won a national championship.
Right. There's no doubt. Well, so what are you hearing? I mean, I've heard, obviously, all the national media mm-hmm. coverage just on different different candidates. You and I even went back and forth a little bit on Twitter on it. I don't know. There's a lot of momentum around Bob Stoops's name. Even, I mean, I don't know how real that is, but obviously there is communication there. What are you hearing? What do you think mm-hmm. as far as guys that give me, like, your front runner, maybe a couple others that are in the mix, and then your dark horse kind of long shot candidate?
Let's just start with what's actually happening right now. You got Bob Stoops as the top candidate. Bob Stoops says he's not a candidate, right? But who determines who's a candidate? Like, if Florida State really likes you and they got you on their board and they want to offer you a shitload of money, you're a candidate to them. Right. Now it's just their job to convince you to take it. So,
right.
So I know for a fact that Florida State's interested in Bob Stoops. There's been some contact. You know how this stuff works. You don't really get offered the job until you're ready to accept it. Like, teams, the negotiations, they talk, they go back and forth, they do the dance. And when the program thinks that they got a coach that's ready to accept, that's usually when the offer goes out. So, people say, well, have they offered, you know, all this stuff? And it's, that's not really how it goes. So I think what's going on now is, based on what we're hearing, is, you know, Florida State hired that search firm.
Yep.
And they've been in town since Monday night, and they were on campus and on a conference call with all the boosters yesterday. They're going through the process. They're going to vet some guys. I know Stoops is one of them. I know his little brother's one of them. Mark Stoops is going to be in there as well in the mix. Some other names that we've heard of interest, I wouldn't say they're to the level of where Stoops is at, but Dave Clawson, Matt Campbell, mm-hmm. And then there's the outside the box hires. You know, do they go with a up and coming coordinator? I don't think so. Not after what happened with Willie Taggart. I don't know if they can make that type of hire. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's
in the Taggart mold, like an up and comer that maybe has a lot of juice behind them, but doesn't have the experience. I don't know if they can do that.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a risky call to do something like that. I mean, you're talking about if it fails, the AD's gone. I mean, the president might be gone. That is a risky thing to do. Now, it might be the have the greatest payoff in the long run, but that's a high risk, high reward hire, really. I mean, to go after a Brent Venables or Jeff Scott or someone like that, that's just... It could work out a la Kirby Smart or Lincoln Riley, but it could also go the complete other direction. And I don't think that's something that they would want to do, you know?
And I don't know. I think this hire is about minimizing risk, right? Because there's not a perfect candidate out there.
I agree.
So, but the right hire might not be a Bob Stoops or something. I was listening to your podcast and you have Doc Holliday, and I remember dealing with Doc a lot back in like 08, 09, 10, like on the recruiting trail, seeing him out and stuff. And I forgot what it's like to talk about coaching with people that actually understand coaching. Like if I put Doc Holliday's name on Twitter, right, I'd get torn apart by the FSU fans.
Oh, absolutely.
And you made a great point about putting together a staff that can recruit, because that's literally just what Jimbo did when he had his boys with him early on during his tenure at FSU. And those guys are really the ones, Eddie Grant and Mark Stoops and James Coley, like those were the guys that really built the foundation for that class. And you've got to have a group that walks as one, especially in recruiting. And I think that was kind of one of the downfalls with Taggart. It was, he didn't have a core group of guys around him. He kind of put together like a mercenary staff. Right. So guys were coming on his staff that were coming to Florida State to maybe bounce to the next job or elevate their status or get paid more. And it wasn't like these guys were coming with Willie Taggart. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I do remember when he first got hired, he was set to hire Mike Locksley as his offensive coordinator. And that was right before Bama promoted Locksley to the full, you know, the main offensive coordinator. But that was, and I don't, Willie and Locksley weren't, I mean, they weren't like tight or anything. I mean, they knew each other, but you could tell he was just kind of piecing together names, not necessarily his core group, like you just said.
He absolutely was. And I think that was kind of one of the things that happened to Willie when he moved so quickly from Western Kentucky to USF to Oregon. It was like he didn't really build up a solid foundation of coaches around him. He had a couple guys and, you know, they probably weren't that ready for a job like FSU. So I think that kind of hurt. So I do like the idea of a Doc Holliday, you know, somebody like that, but what we just said about the risk involved, like that would be an impossible sell right now.
Yo, absolutely.
So you're going to get one of these guys. I think what we're going to get is somebody with experience, somebody that's run a program or been at a big program. They want somebody that is the anti, you know, not to just take a dump on Willie, but the anti Willie Taggart, like somebody that's battle tested, has gone through the rigors and the roller coasters of running a major program. And right now, if you're looking at really either of the Stoops, they kind of fit that bill.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think that's where just my kind of outside perspective, I think Mark Stoops ends up being the guy. I think Bob, I mean, and part of it is...
I had to put money on it right now.
Yeah, and part of it is like, I guess because I was involved with the University of Florida forever and Bob Stoops' name came up every time there was even
every
like...
Every time.
I mean, every time it was like, oh, Spurrier sneezed. Bob Stoops. It's got to be Bob Stoops.
You're like, and how many times did Bob Stoops take that job?
Yeah, zero. Exactly.
Not once.
Exactly. And I think Mark Stoops makes a lot of sense. I mean, what he's done at Kentucky is admirable. I mean, it's outside of maybe the Joker Phillips for a year or two. They haven't had hardly any success in conference in the SEC.
So I got a question for you. How important is this? You know, one of the knocks on Willie Taggart was that he didn't have a 500 record, right? Mm-hmm. So get this, Mark Stoops, if he wins the next three games, wins out, he'll be one game over 500. How important is his record to getting hired at Florida State?
I think it's important, but you got to take it with a grain of salt. Like you look at Willie Taggart.
It's one game, right?
It's
one game.
I mean, I think you know, it's like anything else. People are gonna hook into something like that, whether he does it and is over 500 or is below 500. People are going to talk about it if that hire happens. But ultimately, going 500 at Kentucky, that's pretty damn good.
it'll get you re-signed. It'll make you a lot of money.
No doubt. That's a fact. That's a fact. Well, here, not knowing the staff as intimately as you know the staff, when, let's say, Mark Stoops gets hired or whoever it is, who are the two, or usually on a staff, you're going to have a retention of maybe two coaches, possibly three. Who are the 2 to 3 coaches that you see the new coach retaining for whatever reason, albeit recruiting or just chemistry with the team? Who do you think those 2 to 3 coaches are?
Well, actually, on Monday in my Coaching Insider, I reported that the admin would like for the next head coach to keep 3 guys. Yeah. And this isn't a deal breaker. It's just they would like the new coach to do this. And it would be Odell Higgins, defensive line coach, who's now the interim.
Yeah, has to be.
Bleeds Garnet and Gold. The other, I was told, was Ron Dugans, another FSU guy. He just came from Miami, and I believe he has a 2-year deal anyway. So he just left Miami last year, and he's a former Seminole. And then the third is a quality control coach, and that's Mario Edwards Sr., who's been there for, you know, 5 or 6 years now through a coaching change already. Now, he's not being asked to be promoted to on field or anything. He's just being asked to be kept around. So I've been told that those would be kind of the 3 names that they would want to. Now, obviously you got Kendall Briles out there, right? Yeah. He's owed $1.2 million. But it's hard to saddle a coach with an OC. I don't know how many coaches that are worth a damn would go to a place where they're being told they have to keep this coordinator.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know hardly any that would. And if it was one that would be okay with it, maybe they knew Kendall Briles, it would have to be a defensive coach. There's no way you're going
to
bring
in,
an offensive guy and going to say, hey, and by the way, here's your coordinator. That's a recipe for disaster.
But even if it's Mark Stoops, you don't think he's going to want to bring Eddie Grant with him?
No, he absolutely.
Eddie had success at Florida State already, knows the lay of the land, like is his ace in recruiting in South Florida. So Eddie would, you know, it's hard. I know fans want to be like, well, we already got Kendall here, so it probably looks real appealing for the next coach. And it's like, no, it doesn't really work like that.
No, not at all. I agree. I agree entirely. That's just that's when administrations get too involved. When they start telling you what coaches to keep and not keep or what coordinator you're going to have, that's when it's like, whoa, timeout. Who's running the program here?
Right. Yeah. And it's all negotiation. It just depends on how much leverage you got. And right now, Florida State doesn't really have the leverage to get a big time coach in and say you're keeping these coaches no matter what. Like, yeah. They just can't do that.
No doubt. Well, it's an interesting time to be a Seminole, that's for sure. But I appreciate you coming on, and I want to definitely give you a chance because, like I mentioned before we started, Big Three Roll Up is a huge platform down in Florida. You guys have like 8 million shows. I can't even keep track, but it's really the tailgates for anyone that's listening that has a chance. You got to check out their tailgates when they have them. There, we had a great time, and the show's awesome. So check it out. But tell everyone where they can find you and what shows do they have to listen to.
Yeah, the Big Three Roll Up. That's the big one. That's every Thursday morning, 7 a.m. Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcast, it's there. The Big Three Roll Up is, you know, it's represented by me. I'm the FSU guy. Silks, the Gator guy. Kev is the Miami guy. So it's kind of like three brothers arguing or three friends sitting in a barbershop. I mean, we go at it and we get off topic, and it's really fun. It's a great show. We're going on 3 years now. Big guests, you know, you've been on a couple times. We've had Derek Brooks on, Ken Griffey Jr., Vernon Hargraves. You know, the list goes on. A lot of greats from the Big Three. Charlie Ward's been on, Danny Warfel. It's great. And then we do a show on Sunday called Same Energy Sunday.
If you weren't going to bring it up, I was going to bring it up.
Yeah, that is the show for the people. Let me tell you, that show's really taken off. It's crazy how that show has taken off. So what we do is a call-in only show on Sunday. We don't really break the game down at all. We get on there, talk for like 5 minutes, but we're just taking phone calls. And the idea of the show is the Big Three Roll Up's all about talking shit, being, you know, being out there and being loud. And we say, like, no matter what your team does on Saturday, this show on set, you better bring that same energy that you had win or loss before the game. You better bring it to this show and talk to us. So it's taken off. People love it. We're doing some other things. Like you said, we got so many pods, but go to the Big Three Roll Up, bigthreerollup.com, iTunes, Spotify, wherever.
Perfect. Well, I appreciate you coming on, Josh. Always a pleasure, my man.
Hey, Zach, have me on anytime.
I appreciate it, bro.
See you about it.
All right. All right. Well, I definitely thought that would be some cool insight to get Josh on, and just one, he's really well respected in the recruiting game, the 247 world, and then he has a lot of insider info. And it's interesting to see the demise of that program down at Florida State, and really their efforts to take a risk and maybe bring it back to relevancy, which is what Jimbo Fisher did. And so interesting to see. Really excited about the LSU-Alabama matchup. But check us out on Sunday. We're going to have a couple things going on next week. We're going to launch a little video content. Patreon members are going to get an exclusive video for this. And I apologize, Patreon is kind of... I've just been inconsistent because we're trying to redevelop Patreon. And on Monday, our plan is to relaunch that with the tailgate coming out. By the way, get your tickets to the tailgate. Over half sold. Half the tickets are sold, and we're still not even in game week. So it's going to sell out. Make sure you get those tickets. And then also Patreon, sign up if you haven't yet. And also we're going to revamp it on Monday. So we're going to have some video content coming out. Got some good, audience camaraderie ideas. So really excited to launch it all. But thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening. Hope you were educated, entertained, and enjoyed it. But we will catch you next week.
That's why I don't read the newspaper. Because it's garbage. And the editor that let it come out is garbage.
Or do you do what everybody else in the media does, just create some shit and throw it on the wall and see what sticks, which is what I see happening everywhere.
Where are we at in society today? I'm a man. I'm 40.
When my time on Earth is gone and my activities here are past, I want they bury me upside down and my critics can kiss my ass.